Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous Reads. Today we have special guest Jennifer Saint, debut novelist with her book Ariadne. We're speaking on April 29th, which is her publication day. Congratulations and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Can you introduce us to the story of Ariadne, your novel, as well as the figure Ariadne?
Yeah, of course. So Ariadne is a figure in Greek mythology who's best known for her role in helping Theseus, the prince of Athens, hero of Athens, to defeat the Minotaur. And the Minotaur was actually Ariadne's half-brother, born to her mother as part of a punishment inflicted on the family by the god Poseidon. And the novel tells the story of Ariadne from her perspective, which is a perspective that I felt was missing from the myth, that when it's told normally, we see it through Theseus's eyes and from Theseus's point of view. So I really wanted to give Ariadne a voice and tell it her way.
It's because also she is a figure of some mystery. There are different versions of her that crop up through Greek mythology and Roman mythology. Tell us a little bit about the possible endings, which really allowed you a real toehold in to make it your own.
Yeah, so there's absolutely a lot of conflicting versions of Ariadne in her story. And actually, in some of the versions in mythology, she dies very shortly after helping Theseus to defeat the Minotaur. And in other versions of the story, she goes on to further adventures involving the god of wine, Dionysus. So there's always a huge range of stories about any character in Greek mythology, because these are not stories that existed as one single entity. They were told and retold across different regions of the ancient world by different areas who had their own culture, characters and figures that were more important, you know, in one place than another. So you'll always find there's so many different ways to tell the story of one person.
Well, I think that sounds familiar in terms of, if you just look at Christianity, how different parts of that story are important in different places to different people. There's, you know, some people it's the Virgin, some people it's Jesus, some people it's, you know, a particular moment in his life. So I think we can really equate that way. Is that also why you think it's still important enough to write a novel, obviously, important to keep retelling these stories as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think even though these are ancient stories that were told first, you know, over 2000 years ago, when you tell the stories again, when you read them, when you encounter them in all these different variations that they've been reinterpreted in over the centuries since, there is just this common thread of humanity, of universal feelings and experiences that I think just really connects us to these people of this ancient world that would be so unrecognizable to us in so many ways. But when you tell stories, you see that thread that connects us, the things that we feel and experience that are the same.
I read the Greek myths as a kid and I completely immersed myself in them, but I sort of saw my family in them, because I saw my family in quite mythic terms, and they seemed just as whimsical and powerful and, you know, prone to irrational decisions as do the Greek gods and the humans that they play with.
Yeah, I mean, the Greek gods are, I suppose, just incredibly exaggerated versions of what people could be if they had completely unchecked power and there were never any retribution for their behavior.
Yeah, a bit like celebrities.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, there are no repercussions for them, untouched. Mm. I would like to go back to the story of Ariadne, because the sort of Greek family tree really is the first version of 6 degrees of separation. So everybody is sort of hemmed in by those relationships and rivalries amongst the gods. Give us a little bit of context to Ariadne and her sister Phaedra's childhood and relationships.
The family trees are always very complicated, and one story, one character just leads on to so many others. So Ariadne and Phaedra both have their own quite separate stories in mythology, and one thing I was really interested in with writing the novel was to bring these two sisters together and to see how they would relate to each other rather than just relating to the significant male characters in their stories, which is, I think, perhaps how they're traditionally presented. So when I was looking into that, what I was really interested by was the fact that they shared what would have been a really traumatic childhood experience with this monstrous half-brother, the way in which the Minotaur came to exist, which would have such terrible consequences, I thought, particularly for their mother. I thought that that would really shape who they were, and that would give them a really powerful bond as sisters that I just thought really deserved telling.
Yeah, that I thought was very interesting. And you're right that the mythology does have everything, because what you draw so beautifully is that sisters can have a bond, but as Ariadne is the older sister, for Phaedra, there's no before the Minotaur.
Yeah.
And Phaedra didn't even know him as Asterion, which he was named as a child Asterion. So, Ariadne has a very different take on that. And yet, as you point out, it is a shared experience.
Yeah, so Ariadne is always told as having this special connection with the monster, that sometimes you find her referred to as Mistress of the Labyrinth. So she was sort of the one that had the secrets to the labyrinth and had this kind of more familial relationship. And with Phaedra being the younger sister, I was trying to find an explanation for why that would be true for Ariadne, but not true for Phaedra. And I thought that it would be that Ariadne had seen him when he was more vulnerable, when he was born, before he became the threat and the horror that he became.
Yeah, that was very beautifully drawn. Another thing that I thought familiarly, well, and I think this really goes to what you were saying that drove the novel, mm-hmm. is that, women's voices in these myths are usually, and Ariadne points out that the men they make some of the classic mistakes, like the classic fatal flaws that Aristotle pointed out. And the men perpetrate them and the women pay for them.
Yes. So that's something that you see it absolutely with the story of Pasiphae, that it's Minos's crime. Minos insults the god Poseidon, and Poseidon decides to punish him via his wife. And I thought it really starts there. And when you see that, then you see it repeated through all of these other stories. So you see how it happens to Phaedra later on. And you see how it happens to all of these other female characters in mythology whose stories I wanted to reference as much as I could and to weave in. And Medusa would be the most powerful example of that. That again, Poseidon again, who was the one to commit the outrage, and then Medusa is punished for his crime. And I just thought it's such a recurring theme. And it's something that I don't think has gone away in society. I think that we still see that played out today. So this story that's from an ancient world, I think still has so much relevance.
And even just from, as they say about any organization, the fish stinks from the head. And Zeus's crimes and misdemeanors are always paid for by the women, frequently
always
punished by his by his wife, who has also been wronged, but she meets out that punishment. It's so interesting, and that's why it felt so contemporary. even though, you know, there's magic and there's powers and et cetera. Talk to me about how you made the decision that Ariadne does not die on Naxos, where she and Theseus fled after she helped him to kill the Minotaur. And again, we've said there's various endings to that story, and you decided not to end it there. Tell me about that relationship.
Is it between Ariadne and Theseus?
No, and Dionysus.
Yeah, so it's a story. I think a lot of people are a fan of that relationship between Ariadne and Dionysus, because she fell for Theseus. She fell for that sort of classic hero narrative with Theseus and trusted him and believed him. And he turned out to be something quite different. And then when Dionysus comes along, although he is one of those Olympian gods, he's really quite different in his portrayal and from the other gods. He's much more a friend to the outcasts in society. He's much more a rebel, and his rites are exciting and mysterious and unknown. He's such an intriguing, alluring character. And so when he and Ariadne meet, that gives her a chance to experience something so different to what she would have been able to, and so it's kind of outside the bounds of the society that she's grown up in. So it was a really exciting relationship to explore. But ultimately, although Dionysus is different, he's still part of this patriarchal, misogynistic tradition of the gods. And the dilemma is, to what extent can he overcome that? And, you know, can he prove himself to be that different after all?
Yes, it does. That in particular struck me as a particularly modern dilemma. You know, does a leopard change its spots?
Right.
can you escape your family history? And with all this, you know, modern parallel that I said, with all this money or with all this license at your disposal, will you be the bigger person? You know, it's a tough question.
Yeah, will your ego take over?
Exactly. And you have said that this whole thing was sparked by Ovid's poetry that you discovered, you know, when reading the myths and studying classics. Tell me a little bit about that and how long it's taken you and where that's taken you to this moment.
Yeah, so I was introduced to Ovid when I was at university. So, you know, sort of 20, I'm now 38. So it's quite, you know, like 18 years ago, 16 years before I started writing the novel. And in Ovid's Heroides, he writes this series of letters from the women of mythology, mostly to the men who have variously wronged them, betrayed them, abandoned them, etc. So although I think we think of the idea of retelling mythology from the female perspective is a really modern phenomenon, actually Ovid was doing that in the first century BCE in the Heroides. And that was really a revelation to me, because I loved Greek mythology. That's why I went on to read classics at university. But I hadn't really encountered this flipping of the narrative, this like different perspective, this other way of approaching the stories. And so that stayed with me. But when I finished my degree, I went on to become an English teacher. And although I'm still interested in classics and would read as much as I could about Greek mythology and introduced it into my teaching as well, that idea did go on the back burner for me for quite a long time. And it was probably when my own children started getting interested in Greek myths and I was reading the stories to them. And when we read Theseus and the Minotaur, and you realize how sidelined Ariadne is in that story, that I thought back to Ovid and this absolutely incredible letter that she writes in the Heroides, full of this righteous fury and passion and indignation. And with Phaedra as well, she writes a letter that is so clever and shows her as such an intelligent and again, very like passionate kind of figure, that I thought these women have got such a story to tell, and it's such a wasted opportunity to only tell the story about Theseus.
It's interesting because, you know, again, I mean, Ovid just pinpointed, you know, this is a woman who's not getting credit.
Yeah.
She wants credit for her role in helping, and she had been sidelined. And Fedra really, she is an incredibly, well, tragic figure, but also an incredibly proto-feminist heroine. You know, she was doing things in the way, and exercising her power in the way she could as a woman, as a foreigner in Athens, and that did mean something as a former enemy, et cetera. And you do a really good job of just demonstrating that guest-host relationship that was so important in those times, as well as, you know, the power struggles, et cetera. And so it really is wonderful because you give such texture to these women who were just snippets, and you give them a whole life. You give them a whole loves, hates, struggles, etc. So it's really lovely. And as a writer, what I'm just interested in sort of how you approach it as a writer as opposed to a reader. You've been a reader of these stories for so long, and how do you then sort of insert yourself as one of the writers of them?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's, I think, especially when you grow up with the myths, and you sort of do treat them in quite a reverent way, I think, you know, because these stories have endured so long, because they are so wonderful and compelling, there's kind of a bit of a barrier to overcome when you're thinking, well, now I'm going to take them on and I'm going to try and write my own version, and, you know, can I do it justice? And as well as that, when you are interpreting them for a novel and you want your characters to make sense and be coherent, and you have to breathe a kind of life into them, so they have to become something separate to the stories that you already know. They have to become your own character. So there is a certain amount of having to let go of this image. I've said this to somebody else, this image of, that a lot of angry classicists are going to be reading this over your shoulder as you write and going, that's not what happened. That's not how this character felt or behaved, because you have to create something new from it. And I think that they're so ripe for reinterpretation. And I'm always so interested in what somebody else's take is going to be and how somebody else is going to make that story fresh and different while honoring the tradition that it's come from. So I think it's overcoming the fear of doing that is the first step, and, you know, believing that the story wins out in the end. You do have to make some decisions about things that I'm going to change or things that I'm not going to include, and ultimately I think when you're writing fiction, narrative wins.
And, you know, I suppose the way of sidestepping that is to go back, as you said, to the original versions of these stories that were told, retold, changed, certain things left out, certain things exaggerated. So in actual fact, you're being uber classical.
Yeah.
You've out-classicsed the classics.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Anyway, well, it's absolutely wonderful. Can I ask you, I understand that you are taking another Greek myth and breathing new life into it. Can you tell us what story you're taking on now?
That's right. So for my second novel, I'm approaching the women of a famous story. And this time it's centered around the women in the life of Agamemnon. So his wife Clytemnestra, his daughter Electra, and some of the story takes place in Troy with Cassandra of Troy as well.
Ah, that is one of my favorites. I have to say, I was explaining in brief about the Oresteia to my son, whose friend had just, the father had just left the family. And he said, are the Furies going to come after Philip? You know, because he left. I said, in a righteous world, they would. So thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, and good luck with your second novel.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It's a really interesting conversation. Thank you.